We are talking today with Kenneth Helfand. Kenneth Helfand is professor of landscape architecture at the University of Oregon, where he has taught courses in landscape history, theory, and design since 1974. He is the author of numerous articles and reviews on topics in landscape history and theory, with a particular interest in the contemporary American landscape. He served as editor of Landscape Journal from 1994 to 2002. He is author of several books, including Dreaming Gardens, Landscape Architecture, and the Making of Modern Israel, Yard Street Park, The Design of Suburban Open Space, which he co-authored with Cynthia Geerling. And he's here to talk about his new book, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. Kenneth, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
If you would begin and tell us what was the motivation in writing your current book, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime.
Well, there were two sources. One was the research was actually catalyzed by a single photograph that's in the book. And the photograph is an old stereo photograph, and it shows gardens built by French soldiers, it says, in the Great War, which was the First World War. And this photograph shows these soldiers standing by their really earthen dugouts. Behind them are the blasted trees, which have no man's land on the other side. And then right in front of them are these small, tiny little vegetable gardens. And I had this photograph for years, and it was on my shelf, and I was intrigued by it and tried to understand what it meant. And ultimately, that was kind of one origin. The other was a desire to understand what gardens mean to people. And by looking at the same way that philosophers and psychologists and theologians and others have looked at people in extreme circumstances, I looked at gardens in extreme circumstances, what I call defiant gardens. And there's no more extreme circumstances for human beings than war. So I decided then to look at gardens during wartime. That was the kind of beginnings of this.
All right, maybe you could define a couple things. Define garden for us and then define defiant gardens.
Okay. Defining garden is not such an easy thing. It's like defining, you know, a city or nature or the wilderness or home. These are basic archetypal forms of space that we have. A garden is typically some kind of enclosed or demarcated piece of land, but I like to think of a garden as any idealized landscape, and it can be something as small as something that's a flower pot, or in contemporary America, for example, wilderness areas, which we treat as gardens. We often think of gardens, though, as places that are kind of passive and retreats and not essential to our being. And defiant gardens looks at gardens in extreme and difficult circumstances that might be extremes of environment, of economics, of political, social, psychological circumstances where these gardens are found. And the premise is that if we look at gardens in these situations the same way that individuals have looked at people in extreme situations, it might tell us about the fundamentals of what it is to be a human being. But if we look at gardens in extreme circumstances, it might tell us the fundamentals about what gardens mean to people.
All right. So that original photo was trenches of World War I. So was that the place you decided to start?
It was the place I decided to start, and then looked at in the book at four major case studies, gardens built behind the trenches in the First World War, largely on the Western Front, both by all soldiers on both sides, French, British, American, German soldiers, gardens built in the ghettos under the Nazis during the Second World War, gardens built in prisoner of war and civilian internment camps during the First and Second World War, and gardens built in this country by Japanese Americans who were interned during the Second World War. Those are the major kind of places that I studied, but the book also goes up to contemporary examples in, for example, Bosnia and current gardens that American soldiers have built in Iraq.
So what did you start to find when you looked into this?
What I found was, first of all, I didn't expect to find that much. I had looked in books and pictures of these events and for things at gardens, and the picture books had nothing. And there really was nothing written about any of these circumstances except the gardens built by Japanese Americans in the internment camps. But when I began to look, first of all, I decided that I needed to look for evidence of gardens by the people themselves. So the entire evidence for the book was research into first-person accounts, people's diaries, people's memoirs, actual photographs that individuals had taken. I spent a summer doing research at the Imperial War Museum, for example, in London, which is a great archive of military history, and particularly the history of the First World War. If you went to the library, you went to the catalog, and you looked up gardens, you found nothing. So it took some imagination to look under agriculture and farms and even things like potatoes to find evidence of these. And what I discovered was, in all of these circumstances, all of them, people made gardens. And it was inspiring to me. It was surprising to me. It was surprising even to people in these archives who kind of welcomed me there. It's like I'd be described as the garden guy when I'd go back to the archive the next day. And in fact, in all of these situations, individuals made gardens. Not everybody, of course, but many. And they are inspirational, I think. I think they're often kind of very moving, and they surprise everyone. To consider the fact that in the Warsaw Ghetto, where people were starving to death before they're being shipped to their own extermination, people actually made gardens, largely vegetable gardens, but unbelievably, they also planted flowers, which I find extraordinary.
Did the individuals do it just as an escape? Did you find a particular reoccurring theme amongst all these?
I was looking for ultimately what, again, as I mentioned, what gardens mean to people. And I concluded that there were five, if you want, themes or lessons, all rather deceptively simple, that were critical. And gardens were about five things, or these gardens are about five things. But I think ultimately all gardens relate to these five aspects. And they have to do with, first, gardens are about life. Gardens deal with the plant world, which is organic, and we intuitively recognize that the plant world is alive. And we have an affinity for that, what E.O. Wilson terms biophilia, our connection to anything that's alive. And just seeing something alive in circumstances, in wartime circumstances, where death is omnipresent, anything that's alive clearly attracts one's attention and inspires you and informs some, let's say, kind of motivation or kind of psychological sustenance. Secondly, the gardens are about home, and two kinds of homes, either gardens that were created during war and gardens that people create that remind you of the homes you've had. So you move to some other place voluntarily, as most people do, or here where people were, you know, relocated or dispossessed, they would make places that would remind them of home. And it might be the shape of something. It might be a particular plant. It might be a stone. It might be some artifact they took as a reminder of their home that they hope to ultimately return to. In addition, even in these situations where people are imprisoned, they try to make that into a home, even though it's temporary and horrific and horrible, for example, in the ghettos, of that's where you are. How can you domesticate that? How can you make that your own? So that was the second kind of conclusion, and particularly in the internment camps, Japanese-American internment camps, where people were dispossessed, kind of making a home there was a way of possessing it, a way of asserting one's identity. Thirdly, these gardens, and I think all gardens, were about hope. There's a, since time immemorial, cultures have wondered at the miracle, really. You plant a seed in the dark ground, and it emerges out of that darkness into a plant, into life. Now, we understand that now biologically, but before kind of modern science, people did not. But it still embodies hope that out of this darkness, out of the earth, something can emerge. And all planting, all garden making, all landscape architecture, my profession, embodies hope. These are optimistic things. You don't plant, you plant something with the expectation that it'll grow. You plant something with the expectation not only it'll grow, that people will maintain it and water it and care for it, whether it's just, you know, tomatoes or street trees, for that matter. So the gardens embodied hope in very dramatic ways. The fourth aspect, which actually was one that surprised me in terms of its significance, had to do with work. And over, individuals would describe in their diaries and in their memoirs the satisfactions of work, of the physical labor, of something that in situations where you might be completely bored, like in a POW camp, the sheer aspect of something to do and the pleasures of that. And even though it might be kind of under conditions which are, you know, you're in danger of your life or your life is going to be, will end, people talk about the pleasures of work. And I found that very, very interesting. And lastly, the idea of beauty. I mean, we think of gardens as beautiful places, and they certainly are. To a certain degree, I think the fact that gardens are beautiful kind of masks their deeper meaning. We too often think of beauty as something that's superficial, when in fact it, I think, proves itself to be a profound desire amongst people. And again, over and over in people's accounts, they would talk about the pleasures of seeing something that was beautiful in a time and place when things are ugly. We speak of the kind of ugliness of war, and it is ugly. It's horrible, and it's violent, and it's death, but it's also physically ugly. I mean, a world that's been physically transformed beyond our normal expectations. And people would describe the pleasures of seeing something that was beautiful, that was pretty. And critically, the scale did not matter. It could be a single plant, even at times a single leaf or a single tree or just the color green in a world that's been turned to, you know, mud and dirt, let's say, in no man's land of the First World War, of just the pleasures of that. I spoke with a man named Jan Jagielski, who was the photo archivist of the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, and he described what he called that people in the Warsaw ghetto had what he called fantasy gardens. And what did he mean by that? He meant that people would climb to the upper stories of buildings and look out over the wall that surrounded the Warsaw ghetto. And the ghetto was intentionally, the wall was placed intentionally so any green spaces, any parks were outside of the ghetto. And people climbed up on these rooftops so they could look out over something that was green, that was growing, that was alive, that represented their past life and, at least for them, their hoped-for future, which tragically they did not have.
So a lot of this came from people's actual written accounts, and these were so significant that they would include them in their diaries and journals?
Yeah, absolutely. And they would include them in their diaries and journals. For example, I had no familiarity that there were gardens in the Warsaw Ghetto, but a friend of mine who was doing research on the diary of Anne Frank then was reading other diaries. And there's a book called The Warsaw Diary by an American, young American girl named Mary Berg, who was in the ghetto in its early period and then fortunately was allowed to leave. And she describes the gardens in this ghetto, constructed by a group or run by a group called the Toporol, which was the Society for the Development or Promulgation of Jewish Agriculture, which predated the war. And in the ghetto, they appropriated any vacant land. They gathered seeds largely through smuggling. They planted gardens in the courtyards, because Warsaw is a series of buildings built around courtyards, to grow food. They, in fact, ran schools for people to how do you plant things in this kind of horrible urban condition. They tried to distribute what minimal food they might grow. Now, this was something that might have there were 500,000 people in the Warsaw Ghetto, so maybe, you know, you lived a day longer by food you might have gotten from this. But people over and over talked about the significance of doing this activity in terms of what it meant to them. And that I find that rather extraordinary.
And in the different situations, for instance, let's say with World War One, I mean, you would see this from all sides. All the participants would be doing this.
Yeah, in the First World War, you have the kind of unusual circumstance. In the history of the First World War, the Western Front especially was stabilized almost for about 4 years, where there was just fighting back and forth, and the lines of the trenches kind of barely moved from one side to the other. Between the opposing forces was this horrific landscape of no man's land, where literally everything in it was killed. I mean, everything that was, every animal, every plant, the kind of, it was just this mud environment where people literally drowned in that mud. And then to either side of that were trenches. Behind those trenches, individuals, on both sides, built gardens. I have got photographs of German gardens that German soldiers had built, that British soldiers had built, that French soldiers had built. And that the war was stable so that you could actually grow a garden. When in the Second World War, we don't have that situation in terms of fighting in Europe, so you don't see the same kind of thing. You also had a remarkable phenomena in the First World War, just outside the city of Ypres. Ypres is the kind of battleground of one of the most horrific battles in the First World War, one of the most horrific kind of battlegrounds of history, where literally millions of people died. And in this small town, just about 2-3 miles from the front, the British formed something called the Tock House, or the Talbot House, which the modern equivalent would be an American USO. But the USO in America doesn't start till the Second World War. And this Talbot House, or Tock House, was the first of what became hundreds of these around the British Empire. And if you go to this place, which still exists now as a historic landmark and still is a place for soldiers for rest and recreation, behind this building, where there was a chapel and other recreational spaces inside, to the back of it is a garden. And as you went through the building to the back door to enter the garden through a conservatory, there was a sign there, and the sign is still there, which says, "Come into the garden and forget about the war." And it's a kind of remarkable kind of statement of that the garden could be some kind of relief, some kind of respite, some kind of refuge from the war environment that people were in, of just kind of being in that kind of different space and different setting. And this is something that, for example, horticultural therapists and now science validates, that gardens can be soothing to us. They can be helpful to us. They can, they actually is a kind of biophysical reaction, the kind of being in places and working in places that, again, in the extremes of a wartime environment, it becomes even more critical.
Did you find evidence of, in situations where people were being held prisoner against their will, that there were gardens made by both the oppressors and those oppressed?
I chose to examine gardens where people had some degree of free will. I mean, in these circumstances, soldiers in the First World War, they had the free will to create gardens. In the ghettos under the Nazis, people were prisoners. They were on their way to extermination, but they were permitted, actually, in some ghettos to create gardens. So and in the Japanese-American internment camps, those who were interned were permitted to do this, and the same in most POW camps, for example. So I chose to examine where at least people could have some exercise over their free will. Nelson Mandela, in his autobiography, talks about a garden that he had for many, many years on Robben Island, and that working in the garden and planting seeds and watching them grow, he said, was the only time that he felt free during his imprisonment. And he was actually known as the gardener on Robben Island, and rather skillful at that. So I chose to examine that. There were gardens on the other side, by, you know, the gardens made by those who were the warders and the commandants and those who were in charge. I chose not to examine them. You know, for example, in the concentration camps, there were gardens that were, the commandant had gardens. They were maintained by slave laborers, constructed by slave laborers, but they have a very, very different meaning than those where people had some degree of control over their environment and an ability to kind of assert something positive in these horrific conditions, to try and do something. These gardens, one way of thinking of them is that these were acts of resistance. So how do you resist in a circumstance where you know, if you get out of line, you can be shot, literally. And the garden could be some way of resisting, of trying to make something normal under abnormal conditions and to try and reassert that. Or, for example, I found in the Japanese-American internment camps in this country where all the business of the camps had to be conducted in English. But garden making could be essentially conducted in Japanese. So the way of kind of garden making was a way of reasserting or asserting one's Japanese-American identity while being imprisoned in these camps.
And yet it sounds like, though these are a way of showing your defiance, that they were sanctioned by the powers that be. Did you get any sense for why the powers that be would allow these to occur?
It varies in different conditions. First of all, despite the children's story in the fable, it's almost impossible to have a secret garden. Occasionally in POW camps, there are some accounts of, for example, gardens on rooftops and little corners, but you need, garden is a visible element, so it's virtually impossible to have one that's secret, and you need at least tacit permission, or at times even encouragement. So it varies. For example, in the ghettos, it's only in the early periods of ghettoization that the Germans allowed the creation of gardens. The Warsaw Ghetto ends up being at a certain point where people were either in their homes or hiding in sewers awaiting their deportation. So gardens no longer become possible. But for a short period of time in Warsaw and other ghettos, the Germans did allow them. And they also allowed them for a propaganda value as well. At Theresienstadt, which was supposedly a model ghetto that was filled with gardens, and infamously the Red Cross visited Theresienstadt in 1943, and they saw these beautiful gardens and people and adults and children working in these gardens, and they reported back that everything was just fine. The Red Cross left. The next day, all of those people were sent to their extermination. So those were used just for propaganda value. In prisoner of war camps, it depends on who you were a prisoner of. And during the First and Second World War, that would vary. There was in the First World War, where in fact prisoners were treated on all sides much better than they would be in the Second World War, there was a remarkable camp called Ruhleben, which was just outside of Berlin. It was a racetrack, and it's where British civilians who were in Berlin when the World War I started were interned for the rest of the war, about 7,000 men. And in this camp, the British essentially self-organized themselves. They had a camp newspaper. They had camp government. They had schools. They had education. And they had gardens. And in the infield of this, what was a racetrack, they created in the entire infield a garden. And the Germans encouraged this in terms of self-sufficiency of the camp. They even had, and I found this remarkable, the British can be kind of rather wonderful in this way, and it's a culture that venerates gardens, is they formed a chapter of the Royal Horticultural Society. They even had dues for it. And half the men in the camp were members of the Ruhleben chapter of the Royal Horticultural Society. They had garden competitions for the gardens at the best barracks. And my favorite thing, which I think is rather humorous, and believe me, there's not a lot of humor in any of this research, they had a contest for the best boutonniere. In the internment camps in this country, the government, the U.S. government, actually encouraged garden making. One of the goals of the camps was that the camps should be self-sufficient. So they encouraged the industry. They particularly encouraged agriculture. And gardening is essentially, you know, kind of domesticated form of agriculture. So they encouraged that. And in the internment camps in this country, I think many people know this history, but before the Second World War on the West Coast, the Japanese-American community were really the mainstays of the garden and landscape design industry in Puget Sound and the Portland area and the Bay Area in California, Southern California. You had people who were incredibly skilled as gardeners and landscape designers. And these people were now interned. So you had this reservoir of knowledge and skill, and where possible, because it was not always possible, because the camps were in very desolate and desert, largely desert environments, where possible, they made gardens. And, for example, the gardens at Manzanar in the Owens Valley in California, or Minidoka in Idaho, and other camps as well, were extraordinary. And ultimately, actually, the camp authorities encouraged this and would even take people to visit them and show off the accomplishments of the community from their perspective. And the community also, if you talk to those who were survived the camps and even those who are now either in the camps or children or grandchildren of individuals in the camps, a great pride in that accomplishment.
Did you get a sense for if the gardens increased the survivability of people in the different situations?
In terms of earlier, in terms of food, it would be marginal. In terms of psychologically, absolutely. I mean, I don't think you can point to it in any kind of quantitative sense, but at least I have enough evidence of individuals describing that. I interviewed a man named Roman Kent, who was a survivor of one of the ghettos, of the Lodz ghetto, which was in Poland, and where he and his brother actually had a garden. This ghetto had an area that was semi-rural, where it was divided into garden plots, and individuals actually by lot were given plots. And he spoke of the garden, and this is quoting him, he says, the garden was a lifeline to life. And he meant it in the dual sense of, one, that there was food that they were growing, but also psychologically, and particularly the satisfactions of work, of having something to do. I interviewed a woman named Esther Mishkin, who was a prisoner in the Kovno ghetto, in which now is now Lithuania. And she told me about her father and the garden that he created in the ghetto. And she was about 16, 17 at the time. She was a teenager. And I asked her, did you work in the garden? And she said, no, she didn't really work in the garden. It was her father's. He possessed it. And then she described to me that she said he used to just sit there and watch something grow. And she said it gave him the feeling that someone might survive. Sadly, she was the only survivor of her family. All the rest died in the Holocaust. Other individuals, women, largely women who were imprisoned by the Japanese civilian internees in the Philippines after the Japanese conquered the Philippines in the Second World War. You had this interesting class of women who'd been you know, colonial individuals who led a very, very privileged existence now thrust into these civilian internment and prisoner of war camps where the Japanese actually barely or often did not even feed people. And these women especially were incredibly resourceful in finding food and smuggling and bartering for it and growing things and learning from local practice. And later in memoirs would describe the satisfactions of doing this and the sheer act of having this as something to do as something that helps sustain them. Again, these are extreme circumstances, the most extreme circumstances. And if we kind of take it down to the kind of normal lives we lead, that gardens provide us something. Not for everybody. They're not critical for every individual, but for certain individuals, they are fundamental. And a lot of the things I've researched could be said about music, about art, about poetry, about literature, for other individuals. And these things can be life-sustaining as well.
Did you get a sense for how many people participating in each of these different situations turned towards gardens?
It would depend on very much is a kind of great cultural variability, because gardens, while they're ubiquitous in the world, there's certain cultures that value gardening as an art and as a practice more than others. So, for example, in the First World War, Britain is a gardening culture. To this day, we could be on a radio show now about gardening, and they have dozens of them, and they're incredibly popular. And so it's a culture where people, there's a kind of mass appreciation and understanding of gardening. Also, in the First World War, you have to realize that most of the soldiers were coming from, many of them, not all, many from a rural and agricultural background. So it was part of their history, part of something they knew, part of their normal practice. As I mentioned earlier, in the internment camps in this country, the Japanese-American population, you have another culture that venerates gardening as a practice and as an art form, and then individuals who are incredibly skillful at that and, in fact, admired for their skill. So I think there is very much that the kind of cultural variability. Recently, though, I've both spoken with and emailed American soldiers in Iraq, and in the book I include an account from several soldiers who were members of the North Dakota National Guard, originally farmers, actually by background, creating gardens north of Baghdad and into Crete as well. And they, particularly as Sergeant Carl Quam describes, gardens they made, they acquired seeds from home, and then planted them. They all died because they didn't understand local practice. They learned from the local Iraqis about how to properly irrigate and grow things. And in the book, there's a picture of these two sergeants standing there like American Gothic, proud of their corn crop. More critically, though, Sergeant Quam described to me what he called garden time. And what garden time was he would describe it after a day of being out in the field, in full kind of combat dress, riding around, literally dodging, bullets and dodging explosions, where the temperature is 140 degrees, coming back and then having the energy to kind of work in a garden. And he said kind of doing this was some respite and also some reminder of home. Something that reminded him of kind of the normal pleasures of being in the backyard, having your feet in the grass, and so on. More recently, I actually gave a talk a few weeks ago at a Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. And there was a woman who was telling me about her brother, who was actually in the Oregon National Guard, and gardens that he's been created in Kandahar in Afghanistan. And I emailed him, and he also wrote back about the gardens that he's made, and he talked about the kind of crop, the produce they were growing, particularly this kind of one melon that he just loved, but that the garden was not just a reminder of home, it had the taste and smell of home. And I think gardens are multi-sensory places, and it's not just seeing something, it's holding something, it's touching something, it's smelling something that we have an appreciation for. So this is a phenomena. I mean, sadly, war is happening now in the world. War is, unfortunately, I think, always happening in the world. A phenomena that has not been investigated, but affords satisfactions for people that are critical. I should qualify it. None of these gardens saved anyone's lives. except occasionally food in some of them. The garden could be a respite for people, but not a genuine refuge during times of war. They were a kind of temporary sanctuary. But over and over, people would talk about how significant even the small moments were. And I kind of concluded that it doesn't matter how big the garden is. It could be small. And it doesn't matter how long it is. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, long-lasting, that it's over generations. Even people would describe a fleeting glimpse of something and that they would remember that and that that could help sustain them.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We've just been talking with Kenneth Helfand. He is author of the new book, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime.